welcome to another edition of Irreligiosophy. I noticed in listening to some other podcasts, they usually introduce themselves, which we haven't been doing.
Why would we need to introduce ourselves? The entire site is kind of dedicated to us talking.
I'm Chuck Morris, and this is Leighton Allred. What if they never go to the site?
Well, I guess then they're never going to know
that's
our
why,
names.
That's why we don't have any fans, Leighton.
No, the reason why we don't have any fans is you've got the swine flu right now, and you're trying to get it to me.
All right, yes, I'm sick as a dog. I will probably die any time, maybe even during this podcast.
Which I'm okay with. I can finish it without him. In fact, it'll be more interesting if he's gone.
I'm going to soldier on, though, in the interest of scholarship.
Well, all right, well, this week we've got kind of an interesting topic, and it comes down to the proving the existence of Christ himself. And actually, I think a great opener for us is an article I found from the Times that is entitled "Prove Christ Exists." Excuse me, Judge Orders Priest. And basically, what it's about is this guy by the name of Luigi Cascioli. I'm sure I'm butchering that.
It's beautiful.
But he was actually somebody who studied for the priesthood, but later became a complete atheist. And in fact, he wrote a book called "The Fable of Christ."
Can you be a partial atheist?
Actually, judging from last week's guest podcast, I would have to say yes.
That's true. I would classify him as a partial atheist.
Partial atheist, yeah. He hasn't gone completely atheist, but he's going atheist.
He's becoming. He's emergent atheist.
Emergent atheist. All right. Well, this Signor Cascioli, or whatever he is, he wrote a book called The Fable of Christ. And basically, he had this guy he knew, Father Righi, who actually denounced him in a parish newsletter. And so he actually sued the guy concerning it. And the judge ordered this priest who had written this newsletter to prove that Christ even existed.
So we're going to help the priest today by going over the evidence for the historical Jesus.
Yes, although there's...
Hopefully he's listening to this podcast and speaks English.
Quite possibly not, considering this article was from January 2006. Very recent here on Irreligiosity.
Excellent. All right, how I'd like to structure this is, let's go over the pagan sources first.
All right.
Then we'll move closer and closer to Christianity. We'll go into the Jewish sources, and then we'll tackle the documents in the New Testament themselves. Does that sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan to me. You have any particular pagan source you'd like to start with?
Well, let's go over all of them.
All right. Well, we got plenty. I mean, we've got Tacitus. We've got plenty to choose from.
Let's do it chronologically. I think Pliny's the first one. So Pliny the Younger.
Pliny the Younger. All right.
He actually, what was he, the nephew of Pliny the Elder?
I believe so. Hold on. He actually wrote a letter, which is where it was actually Trajan's response, but... Yeah.
Pliny the Elder actually was kind of a naturalist, and he was so curious that he was interested in the eruption that destroyed Pompeii, walked out of Pompeii from Mount Vesuvius.
Yeah.
And he was so curious, he got really close to it and ended up dying.
Well, as I've always believed, is human's nature, when you see something you don't understand, you get as close to it as you possibly can.
All right, so Pliny the Younger was, what was he, governor or procurator or something like that? One of the Roman provinces?
Well, I know he was a judge. I'm not sure exactly what he was. But basically, how we come across this reference is he's writing to Trajan because he doesn't quite know what the letter of the law is where trying these Christians is.
It had arisen because I think Trajan was afraid of people banding together and
getting into large groups,
having meetings and plotting against him and overthrowing him, right?
Yeah.
So that caused a bunch of problems throughout the empire, because if you can't band together, then you can't really have a fire brigade. Or so he was asking, you know, about the fire brigade and to clarify some things. And he also asked, you know, there are a bunch of Christians who are meeting together before dawn, and they're worshiping Christ as God. What should I do with these guys?
Yeah, he's asking, should I discriminate with their ages? Should, if they repent, am I allowed to offer them just a reprieve from everything, or does that even matter, so on and so forth.
Right, and keep in mind, this is the year 112 of the Common Era, so this is 80 years plus after Christ died.
Mm-hmm. Kind of sad that this is the earliest real paganistic source.
Yeah, and the first century seems to have gone completely under the radar for pagan sources.
Yeah, my favorite was actually Trajan's response to this, and I've actually got it. I'll just quote it. "You observed proper procedure, my dear Pliny, in sifting the cases of those who had been denounced to you as Christians, for it is not possible to lay down any general rule to serve as a kind of fixed standard. They are not to be sought out. If they are denounced and proven guilty, they are to be punished, with this reservation that whoever denies that he is a Christian and really proves it, that is, by worshipping our gods, even though he was under suspicion in the past, shall obtain pardon through repentance."
So it's really frustrating, I think, for Pliny, because he would bring these Christians in. He'd say, "Look, are you a Christian?" They'd say, "Yes." He's like, "Are you sure you're a Christian? Because I'm going to kill you." "Yes, I'm a Christian." "Look, all you have to do is say, I don't even care if you believe it or not. Just bow down before this idol once and then go on your way."
Yeah, you know, bow down, pray to it. Hey,
but by this time, they've got a martyr complex. So a lot of them end up dying. But this shows that they weren't systematic in their persecutions anyway.
No.
This is the first pagan source. Occurs nearly 80. Remember, this is all, as far as the pagans are concerned, they're just kind of seeing this pop up here and there.
It's
this new superstition or whatever, new belief.
Just they're always skeptical. Infestation, really. Yeah. It's just an infestation which they're trying to stomp out because the reason why they were trying to stomp it out, though, is because as far as they were concerned, anything that has lasted the test of time obviously is true, and this was something that was very new and very radical to them.
Right, so they're always skeptical of new stuff. All right, moving on, the next pagan author who mentions Jesus, or possibly mentions Jesus, is Suetonius. Have you read any Suetonius?
Not anything beyond what he was possibly discussing where Christ is concerned.
I've read his 12 Caesars, and if Tacitus is like the New York Times or Wall Street Journal of Roman history, Suetonius is like Weekly World News or National Enquirer. He's actually really interesting to listen to because he gets all the gossip about these emperors. and he goes over the first 12 Caesars, starting with Julius Caesar. And he gives all these rumors and all this really salacious material that no one else talks about. He's great. Get a chance, read it.
Oh, I'll definitely have to after this. And the interesting thing to remember here is Suetonius actually lived from AD 75 to 160. So, I mean, we're talking, he wasn't even born until 45 years after Jesus was crucified.
Right, so he's writing his 12 Caesars. I think it was published in the 110s, so it's really close to Pliny. What he says is that around the year, 50 or so, when he's talking about Claudius, the Jews instigated a riot at the hands of Crestus, which is spelled Chrestus. And they were expelled from Rome. Now, this could be a reference to Christ. If it is literally a reference to Christ, then Christ not only resurrected 3 days after he died, but he hung out for about 20 years.
And also led a rebellion.
Right. I mean,
he was
that's
just
awesome.
Kind of sitting around. Now,
it's a totally different type of Christianity.
If that's the case, why is it Paul never met Christ?
Yeah. Or it could be his followers, and it's not really clear. I think it's probably a riot. It was instigated by a guy named Crestus.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having two Richards here,
right?
I mean, I don't know.
The only reason we even bring this up is people are so desperate to find pagan sources that they'll include this, and I think this is probably not a Christian source.
Well, see, I mean, that's the interesting thing is something that we're trying to point out here is there are so few pagan sources about something like this. That it's really difficult to even establish that Christ actually existed. And the funny thing, I know some of you out there are going to be sitting there thinking, well, why would the pagans write about the Christians? But John the Baptist was actually very well known, and he's very well documented in pagan resources.
Well, at least in Josephus.
In Josephus.
Was he documented in pagan resources? They thought Judea is probably a backwater community.
Backwater.
I don't think they paid much attention. But yeah, he is documenting. He spends a bunch of paragraphs talking about John the Baptist and Josephus.
Yeah.
We'll get to him a little bit later. But so that's all. Even if Suetonius is speaking about Christ, what do we have here? We have something that is at least 65 years after the events that it narrates. He wasn't even born at this time. And it just says that there was a mob of Jews and they were expelled, or Christians, I guess, and they were expelled. It doesn't tell us anything about Christ himself.
Yeah, all it says is instigation of Christus. And someone named Christus was leading a rebellion.
Very vague.
And if that was Christ, there's no wonders he was crucified.
He probably got crucified a second time.
Yeah.
That really killed him.
I mean, you really want to piss the Romans off. Let's lead a riot.
All right, so let's move on to Tacitus. He wrote about 115, I think, of the Common Era. His Annals, I think, of Rome. And in there now we actually have something we can pin down as actually giving us some information. It's very short, so we can read this one too. It says, Christus, from whom their name, and that's the Christians. So Christus, from whom their name is derived, was executed at the hands of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. And then he says, you know, that the superstition that emerged after Jesus first appeared in Judea and then it spread to Rome. And that's it. Tacitus is wrong in that
Pontius
Pilate was not just a procurator, he was a prefect, so he had control of military resources as well.
Yeah.
So he at least got one detail wrong. But it's useful telling us stuff, I guess, because of Pliny, it's stuff that we already know, that there were Christians in 115 of the Common Era, and they had stories about Jesus being executed by Pontius Pilate under Tiberius.
Well, however, I would like to point out that this is a very small group. And the reason why I say small is the only reason why Tacitus was bringing it up was because Nero burned down a city because he wanted to build up something else, and then he blamed the Christians for burning it down.
Yeah, and we're not sure that's accurate either.
Yeah, I mean, that's a speculation, but that was the common belief, and so Nero rounded up a bunch of Christians, had them confess, and then they rounded up more Christians and just kind of threw the blame on them.
Right. So we have those three pagan sources. And remember, the first one's in 112, 80 years after Jesus was crucified. And really doesn't tell us anything. All we know is stuff that we know that probably the Gospels, either the Gospels were already written and available, or these stories were circulating still orally at this time. So it doesn't really give us any more information than we already know. But this is it. In the first century after Jesus, you have Pliny, Tacitus, and possibly Suetonius. That's it. Total.
And the interesting thing is, I know a lot of people are going to sit down there and go, well, wait a minute. This was the first century AD. I mean, where would the literacy come from?
Well, 10% of the population probably at any one time was literate. Jesus was able to read.
Obviously.
We don't know if he was able to write. Those were two separate skills in ancient antiquity, I guess is what I'd call it. My brain's a little fuzzy right now,
muddled,
given
well,
the 104 temperature.
Swine flu. Yeah. Don't worry, I'll stick him in a bathtub of ice later.
Perfect. So there are not many people, but what this tells me is that the Gospels, as they're written, could not possibly have occurred. Yeah. If Jesus was feeding 5,000 people, if he was resurrecting people from the dead, if massive crowds of people followed him, if there were palm fronds thrown in front of him on his triumphal entry,
if he was overturning things in the temple, I mean, really, he would be a rabble rouser, a complete troublemaker.
Then you would have heard something about it from some source in the pagan world. Now we do have a source in the non-pagan world, a Jewish source. And this is a historian who was perfectly primed to talk about Jesus because he was born, what, 5 or 6 years after Jesus was crucified?
Uh-huh.
He was born in Galilee.
Yep.
He later became a general in Galilee and led a revolt against Rome. This guy was in the area that Jesus preached in the generation right after him.
Yeah, and this is the one who actually brought up John the Baptist a lot.
Yeah, who better? Who's also in Galilee, right?
Yeah.
Who better to
discuss this great man Jesus,
right? Exactly,
who was actually there and who fed 5,000, so on and so forth. However, even his passage was just limited.
He's a historian. He's interested in collecting stories. Stories about Jesus ought to be running rampant through Galilee like wildfire at this time.
Yeah, I mean, the dude walked through there, fed 5,000, raised the dead, healed people, and Josephus just barely mentions him.
So what we have in Josephus are two possible mentions of Jesus. The second source, the one that's later, is 20.9.1. Yeah, so it's volume 29, page 1. I don't know what it is. Anyway, it
yeah,
mentions...
Very scholarly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
It mentions just briefly that he's talking about a priest. They dragged James in front of the Sanhedrin. So they brought before them the brother of Jesus who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others. And that's it for that reference.
Quite a bit of information there.
Right. I'm skeptical. This one actually seems to be accepted by scholars almost universally. There's a consensus that this one is accurate. I'm not sure how you can tell this is accurate because it could... does it back up anything in the Bible that we know of?
No. And not only that, but I mean, as we discussed previously, there could be other Christs out there.
Or he could have said James and Jesus, which are very common names.
Yeah.
James, this guy named James was dragged in front of the Sanhedrin. His brother was Jesus. And then, you know, either that or who was called Christ could have been inserted in later. We have no idea. Yeah. We don't have that original manuscript.
And see, that's actually something that has been proven, is that in a lot of these manuscripts, there have been insertions at a later point.
Right. You got to think about who's copying Josephus. The Jews? Nah. Josephus was seen as a traitor to the Jews because he switched sides instead of killing himself at the end of the war.
That was actually a very interesting little story there.
Yeah.
Him and one guy are left, and he turns to the other guy and says, hey, let's not kill ourselves.
They're surrounded. They're going to give up. He says to his men, okay, draw lots. And they all drew lots, and they killed themselves up until him and another guy. They're the last two. And he says, let's not do it. Let's just...
Yeah. I'd rather not kill myself.
And then, very smart, he says to Vespasian, I've had a revelation from God, and you're going to be an emperor very soon.
Yeah.
And it turns out after like three successive emperors, Vespasian brought his troops into Rome, became emperor.
Yeah.
So he didn't forget that, and he gave Josephus a house and a stipend, and that's when he started working on this Jewish stuff. But keep in mind also, every time Josephus mentions a Messiah, it's in a negative light. Why? Because he's writing this for Roman authorities. He's right next to the emperor. If he mentions the Messiah and he says, I believe this guy's the Messiah, first of all, he wouldn't have been a Jew, he would have been a Christian. Second of all, he would have said he would have been executed probably for publishing that. That's
exactly.
Treason.
I mean, especially you do not, I mean, this is Rome we're talking about here. You do not put anybody above Rome's authority.
Right. So basically what he's saying is there's a legitimate king of the Jews in Judea, basically.
Yeah.
This one, I think, is more accepted because he says who was called Christ and not because he says Jesus who was Christ. So that one may or may not be authentic. It's funny that he mentions tons of other false messiahs. There's the Egyptian. There are guys that brought up to the river, so they're going to, you know, have this big miracle. They're going to part the waters. They were slaughtered by Roman troops. He spends a lot of time on other messiahs. If this is a true reference, three words on Jesus? Four? All right.
And yet again, I'd like to point out that, I mean, there's so little documentation on Jesus himself that it really wouldn't even surprise me if this was an insertion.
Right. So what we have here are Christians who are copying this, not because they love Josephus, but because he mentions John the Baptist, maybe James, and this sort of thing. So the Christians are doing this. The Jews didn't copy this at all. It was all Christians. And we all know Christians insert stuff in there.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the big one, which is the Testimonium Flavianum. Let's read this because it's pretty important. This was published in the year 93, so this is the first century. Now, there was about this time, Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. So here we have Testimonium Flavianum, which people point to regularly as evidence that Jesus was a big figure, and even Josephus mentioned him and said he was the Christ. And my problem with this is Josephus was a Pharisaic Jew to the day he died, living under a Roman emperor's good graces.
I mean,
if
he would have published something like this, he's living in the Roman emperor. Just like we said, he would have been killed.
Right.
I mean, literally.
I think the consensus on the Testimonium Flavianum is that at best it is a partial interpolation. Possibly, they say, people, well-meaning or well-intended Christians inserted some stuff in there. Maybe in this passage he said stuff that, you know, about this time there's a wise man named Jesus who some called the Messiah. He was executed, said to have rise again on the third day. And, you know, he's got a tribe of Christians named after his name. So they take all the confessional aspects out of it and they say, well, this is probably what's in there. And I say, why? If that's partial interpolation, if again, which obviously at least parts of that are wrong, why would you not just toss the whole thing out? And there are a couple reasons I think that are very strong arguments for tossing the entire thing out.
And what might those be?
One is if you take the paragraph above and the paragraph below and you read them without the testimonium, they flow completely together.
Seamlessly.
Remember, he says there are lots of wonderful things and all the divine prophets talked about Jesus and the tribe of Christians, blah, blah, blah. And then the next line is, and then another calamity occurred. You're like, what the? He just confessed the Christ. How is that a calamity? But there was a calamity in the paragraph above it. So if you take the paragraph out, it flows right in there. That, to me, says it wasn't in the book.
Yeah.
It was not in the book. Second, the first time we see this is with Eusebius, who was a church father who I believe was in the 4th century. This is the first time we get. Now, remember Celsus, who's talking about, yeah, you know, they're arguing back and forth. Christians, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Irenaeus, Origen, all these guys are arguing against pagans. It would have been very nice to have this passage there in the 2nd century.
Very much so.
Say, hey, look, Josephus did this. Nobody says it, all the way up until the 4th century in Eusebius.
Yeah. And see, my biggest problem with this entire passage is if Josephus was such a believer and this occurred later on, why is it in the first mention of Christ it's so simplistic? And yet in this one, he goes on and on and on about it. It seems like a blatant insertion.
It's giving away the entire thing. This is exact. What a coincidence that we find exactly within Josephus what a Christian would like.
Yeah.
He was crucified, and at that time,
rose the third day.
They hated the Jews, right? So at the behest of the principal men among us, and Josephus is a Jew. So behest of the Jews, Christ was crucified. He rose again the third day, did a bunch of miracles. This is exactly what they want. Yeah. What a coincidence they find it.
Very much so. I mean, how would you in that day and age love better than to see proof? Oh, wow, look at this. Someone bringing it forward. And there's, I mean, as we've said before, there's obvious insertions. There's even just blatant lies that went around with some of the Gospels.
Eusebius is guilty of that as well. He fabricated a letter from a king of a town to Jesus saying, oh, you created wonderful miracles. You've raised the dead. You've healed a bunch of people. I was wondering if you'd come over to my city and heal me because I've heard that the Jews are out to get you. Jesus writes back and he says, oh, that's great. I'd be happy. Blessed are you who believe in me who have not seen me. keep in mind that this is before the Gospels have been written, right? As well, Jesus is still alive. And we don't know at all about the Jews conspiring. It's just horrible. So he has a track record of making the stuff up. But when he first mentions this, he gives a different location than where we see it now. He says, after giving this account of John, so John the Baptist, in the same part of the work, Josephus goes on to speak as follows of our Savior, and then the testimonium. Well, the testimonium actually is before. In our manuscript that we have right now, testimonium occurs before he talks about John the Baptist.
Yet again, more proof again, to me that it's got to be just a blatant fabrication.
You put all of this stuff together, the fact that Origen mentions the James, brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, and Origen says that Josephus didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ. You put all that together with everything else, the fact that it's not seen until the 4th century, the fact that Eusebius is known for making this stuff up, the language seems Eusebian. It is stuck in a place where it really doesn't seem like it belongs. There is
between two calamities. Well, why not talk about Christ?
And then another calamity occurred, just like the calamity of Christ. I would say that this, to me, there's no doubt this is a fabrication. Yeah. Out of whole cloth, is a fabrication.
Well, see, my point behind this isn't really scholars who need to prove this, because obviously it seems a complete fabrication. I think it's the believers who need to prove this. So why not find something that backs this?
I've never found a good reason for accepting the testimonium, even that's been stripped out of all of the confessional, Christological stuff. I've never found a good reason for accepting it as genuine. Do you think Origen would have just not read that part? He was familiar with the Antiquities.
Of course. I mean,
he knew the smaller part. He didn't know the bigger one? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it. In the first century after Christ died, because the first century AD, you've got zero pagan sources, up from 0 to 100. So if you go 100 years after Christ died up to 130, you've got 3 pagan sources tops, and then possibly one reference from Josephus.
At best, one.
That just says he was called Christ.
Yeah.
Not impressive for someone who changed the course of Western civilization and became the dominant religion over the next 2,000 years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that you have a man walking on water and Josephus in that town didn't even hear the rumors of it, really.
Yeah, clearly. And there, again, there was another, I think his name was Justus. He was a historian, and Josephus hated him, didn't like him at all. There's nothing in Justus that mentions Jesus as well. And Justus also grew up in Galilee.
Yeah, I remember reading about that a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Again, zip, zero, nada, nothing. You got, clearly, Jesus did not make an impact in his own day.
I mean, at best, I figure if Jesus did exist, at best, he maybe had a small group of followers and... I think he did exist, and I do think he was crucified. That I do
quit
think
given happened. Quit given the argument. You're fast forwarding. We haven't got to that part yet.
We'll get there. All right, continue. Where are we going next? All powerful Charlie.
Now we're going into the New Testament itself. New Testament document.
All right, so we need to be talking about the Gospels.
Well, let's talk about Paul first.
Oh, Paul. Well, there's a good one to start at.
Because Paul's the earliest we got, right? He was probably writing in the 50s. Paul's an interesting source because he's only writing 20 years after Jesus was supposedly crucified. He is our earliest source of all.
Yeah.
So we can tell a lot from this because you haven't had a whole lot of time. Well, 20 years is a lot of time to play telephone, but you haven't had as much time as, say, the Gospels, another 20 years, or another even 20 years after that for John.
Yeah.
So... this is our first actual information that's the closest to the time that we have.
Now, interestingly enough, we say Paul is the earliest writer about Jesus, and there's a guy by the name of John E. Remsburg who wrote a work on the Christ, and he basically compiled 42 writers who lived and wrote during the time or within a century after the time of Christ, and not one of them mentioned Christ.
Right. We should have discussed this in the pagan section, but the first century is one of the best documented centuries we have in antiquity. We have writings of tons of poets, natural philosophers, legal writings. We have tons and tons and tons of pagan writings. We don't have as many Jewish writings because the temple was destroyed in the year 70. And then again, I think in the 130s.
Which the temple is something we'll come back to.
Judea was destroyed. So, Jerusalem anyway, defeated. So, but our documentation of Caesar Augustus and the first century, very, very thorough.
And once again,
no mention of Jesus.
Once again, I'd like to point out, Jesus, if he made quite the ruckus as he did... why is it there's no mention of it?
Yeah, I think it's clear evidence that the Gospels, that the history didn't really occur as the Gospels related, if there were any doubt about that.
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about Paul.
Yeah.
Paul, our earliest writer, writing in the 50s, gives very few details about Jesus. His story is that he was on his road to Damascus. He was persecuting Christians as a Pharisaic Jew. And he had a conversion experience. It differs if you read it in Acts versus his own writings.
Yeah, as to what he does after the experience.
And even the experience itself, you know, was there a loud voice? Did everyone hear it? Did just Paul hear it? Did he go straight to Jerusalem? Did he wait 3 years? But he had this conversion experience, so this vision of Jesus. He didn't know Jesus when he was alive, but apparently had this sort of visionary experience of Jesus and was converted to Christianity. So he writes a bunch of these letters. What he does is he goes and he's like a leather worker. So he sets up shop in a city. And he was pretty much Gentile only. He didn't really mess around a lot with the Jews himself. He was the apostle to the Gentiles. So he'd set himself up in a community. He'd sell leather goods. He would proselytize while these people are milling around and trying to buy his goods. He'd tell them about Jesus and the good news and blah, blah, blah. And eventually enough people converted that he would pull up stake and go to the next town. So he did this in Colossus. He did it in Corinth. He did it in Ephesus, Thessalonica. When he was traveling, he'd get letters from these groups saying, we're having problems. How do we solve these? Because there wasn't a hierarchy in Paul's day. In Paul's churches, they were just they were baptized, and when they were baptized, they got gifts of the Spirit. They could speak in tongues, they could interpret tongues, they could prophesy, et cetera, et cetera. And no one was at the head of the congregation. They just get together, they'd have meals together, and you know, talk about Jesus.
Well, I mean, Paul really didn't set up anything that was meant to be permanent. I mean, it wasn't.
He thought that the end times would happen before he died.
Yeah.
Like everyone else after Paul.
And everyone else that's still in this day and age believing in Christianity.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that 2,000 years later they can say that stuff with a straight face. But so we have a out of the 27 books in the New Testament, I think 13 are written by Paul. But of those, there are a bunch of questions. 2 Thessalonians is under dispute. The so-called Deuteropauline epistles, there's a question whether he authored them or not, going back and forth. The scholarly consensus is on three epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, that those are clear forgeries. Why? Because they assume a hierarchical structure, bishops, deacons, elders, that didn't exist in Paul's time. So clearly they were written in the 2nd century.
Yeah, which the 2nd century is actually when they started organizing. They started reading through all of the different gospels that were out there, the Gnostic gospels, so on and so forth,
sure,
and deciding exactly what this religion was going to be about.
Sure. It's kind of interesting that if the gospels were written against scholarly consensus in Paul's time, or if Paul had access to them, he shows absolutely no knowledge of the gospels. It would have made a lot of his letters very easy. He spends pages and pages talking about, you know, can we eat meat that was sacrificed to a pagan god? Whereas he could have just quoted Jesus saying, it is not what goes into your mouth, but out of it that defiles you, right? But no, he argues and argues. And if he had bishops, he could have just said, hey, this is a letter to the bishop, not to the Galatians.
Why are you
bothering? Straighten them out.
Yeah.
So what does Paul know about Jesus?
Very, very little, in fact. No miracles whatsoever are
mentioned. No miracles. No virgin birth. Which is significant because Paul and Mark, the two earliest accounts, do not mention the virgin birth. What does that tell you about it?
Well,
you Mark, think that'd be an important detail?
Well, I would think so, but Mark also doesn't have all the most of the miracles. He's missing a lot of the miracles.
It's interesting in Mark anyway that Jesus does miracles and tells people to keep quiet about it, right?
Yeah.
His messiahship in Mark is a secret, as opposed to John, where he says specifically, I do these miracles so that you might believe in me.
Yeah, please take a look. Take a look.
So Paul says about Jesus, Jesus was born of a woman.
Surprise, surprise. If he would have been born of a man, I would have been a little
that
bit more
interested. That would have been a true miracle.
Yeah. Ooh, I'd feel bad for that man.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul, for letting us know that Jesus was born of a woman. Jesus had brothers, one of whom was named James. He had a last meal with his apostles. He was betrayed by one of his disciples. He was executed, and he was resurrected.
Yep.
I believe that is all we have from Paul about Jesus. None of the miracles, none of the teachings. Oh, there are two teachings. Don't get a divorce and pay your ministers.
Well, sounds good to me, especially when you're figuring that the world is going to end.
Right, yeah. That's a lot about Paul, you know. He's like, you're a slave now? Well, don't worry about it. The world's going to end soon. Don't try to change your status. If you're single, stay single. The world's going to end soon. If you're married, stay married. So that's Paul, essentially in a nutshell. And it's interesting that Paul, I think, preaches a different gospel than the one that we are most familiar with.
Well, Paul's is a bit misogynistic.
Maybe. one of those letters that's really misogynistic, I think it's either Timothy or Titus, wasn't by Paul. So he may have gotten that reputation undeservedly.
Just undeserved? Well, possible, possible.
So that's pretty much Paul. Paul thought that you could be saved just by accepting the fact that Jesus died for your sins and was brought back and he's your Lord. So you just confess and believe in it and you're saved. Basically, you'll go into heaven. He said, you know, naturally, you know, you'll be good after you accept this. But the big thing isn't works. It's the fact that you've accepted Jesus. but there's a passage, I think, in Matthew where Jesus says to a bunch of the people, he's the Son of Man now, and he's judging people. And he says, all right, sheep's to the right and goats to the left. All the sheep, come sit by my right hand or come into the kingdom of God. You are the people who clothed me when I was naked, visited me when I was in prison, fed me when I was hungry. And they said, what? We've never met you before. We don't even know who you are. And he said, when you've done this to the least of these people, anyone, you've done it unto me. Interestingly enough, that contradicts with Paul because these people aren't even Christians. They have no idea who Jesus is, but they've just done good works. And that is a criteria that Jesus sets for getting into heaven. Now, it's possible that Paul, as an earlier source, is more accurate. However, I'm not sure that later Christians would have said, hey, even if you're not a Christian, come in, join the kingdom.
Yeah. Because, even today, that isn't something that...
Right. You don't say. You need to convert, right? You need to pay your 10%. Yeah. Come to church.
You need to be baptized. You need to believe. You need to convert. I mean, who cares about the good works?
So that's I'd probably put more emphasis on that. And I wish they would put more emphasis, not on belief in Paul and dogma, but on good works.
Yeah, on the actual parables, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, some parables.
Very true. Very true. Well, now, interestingly enough, before we continue on with the Gospels, there is one bit of fascinating truth out there that I discovered in the research for this podcast, and that is that in the early depictions of Christ, the symbol of Christianity, it wasn't a man nailed to a cross. It was actually a sheep or a lamb nailed to a cross, and that was the symbol of early Christianity. I mean,
I thought it was a fish.
Well, that's Darwin.
So nail the fish to the cross.
Well possibly. But, I mean, it's very fascinating. And every once in a while, this lamb would have the head of a man, something like that.
It's like an Egyptian god. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, except it's kind of backwards because then they have human head bodies. Animals, with, yeah. Nice. Thanks for the parallel. Well, anyway, it wasn't until Pope Hadrian I in the 8th century, if I'm not mistaken, that he actually said, you know what? We need a man up there on the cross. This is our new symbol from here on out. And it's interesting because a lot of people who don't believe that Christ actually existed look on this as they were believing that the Lamb of God was out there somewhere and that Christ was just kind of developed around this concept of, oh, wait, we need a man up there, not a sheep.
Huh. I'm not sure I buy that.
I don't really buy it either, but it was very interesting to read about.
I think a better explanation, assuming that's true, I've never heard of it before. Assuming that's true, a better explanation would be the people's favorite gospel typically is John. It's the one where he says, I am the bread, I am the light of the world, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He speaks in long speeches instead of short parables and witty sayings.
Yeah, people can understand it a little bit.
Yeah, better. He's kind of the most accessible in John. And in John, John's the only gospel that mentions Jesus, refers to him as the Lamb of God. So clearly, if this symbol was widespread, it's because of the Gospel of John referring to Jesus as the Lamb of God.
Yeah. Honestly, I agree with you, but I found it very interesting.
Plus, the depictions that we have, Jesus up on the cross in a diaper, no. He would have been naked. He would have been nude.
Yep.
Why waste a diaper? The Romans were very efficient. They crucified, even females were crucified nude.
So much for early porn.
I love it. They're so modest. They put a little diaper on Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, we can't be showing that to little Romans walking by.
All right, so let's move on to the Gospels. And I'm almost losing my voice here, so why don't you take it over a little bit?
little old me. Now,
talk away.
Can you actually trust me with something like this? No, obviously not. Well,
but I have no choice.
Forget Charlie. I believe the hand of God is pushing me forward to be the headliner.
It's keeping me down.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, as we've discussed before, the earliest gospel is Mark in and of itself. And there are huge contradictions between the gospels themselves. I mean, you have the gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the synoptic gospels. And
do you know why they're called the Synoptic Gospels?
I haven't the foggiest idea. I was actually looking for that.
They're called the Synoptic Gospels because they share a common theme. It's called the Markan spine. So it took scholars a while to figure out that Matthew and Luke came after Mark. In the original church, they thought that Matthew came first. That's why it's the first book in our New Testament. And they thought Mark was just an abridgment of Matthew for people with short attention spans, like the Reader's Digest version of it.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that both Matthew and Luke have stories that are exactly verbatim from Mark. And when they depart from the stories in Mark, when they change things, they change them differently. So clearly, Mark was the first one. But the reason is that the Synoptic Gospels, you can take all the events in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you can put them in three parallel columns, and you can see the event in Matthew, the event in Mark, the event in Luke. So synopsis means same sight. You can just see those same events and see what changed and what stayed the same. That's why they're called the Synoptic Gospels.
And
carry
the
on.
Relevance behind that is now shot down as he dies. Are you all right, dude?
You're I'm all right.
All right. Well, interestingly enough.
You have a bucket I could vomit in?
I could take off my shoe.
All right.
All right. So what we have here is Mark was written about the year 70, roughly. Luke about 110.
So, do you know who Mark was?
Do I know who Mark was?
Yes. I've asked as many people I know about this question. No one yet has got it right. No. Who was Mark?
Actually, I have no idea who Mark was. I know he wasn't the apostle that everybody was saying he was, and I have a
typically,
vague remembrance.
Typically, that's the answer I get.
No.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were apostles.
No.
Wrong. Only two were apostles, Matthew the tax collector and John the beloved, right?
Yeah.
So that leaves Mark and Luke. Who are these guys? Mark, by tradition, was supposedly the secretary of Peter, or Peter's scribe, who followed him around writing down a bunch of lectures. Yeah. And that's who they ascribe it to. But the book itself never says that it was written by Mark. And none of these gospels do, actually. Luke was a traveling companion of Paul. And so when they're doing these ascriptions, you have none of these ascriptions before the end of the second century, but then they got into doctrinal wars, and so they wanted to start forming a canon. They just wanted this gospel, and I wanted to argue out of this gospel. So they started attributing it either to apostles or very close to apostles. Anyway, that's who Mark was. And it astounds me that I got, and I didn't know that until I listened to Bart Ehrman's stuff, right?
That's probably where I heard it, because that's how I knew it wasn't the apostle. Is I've heard it before, but I couldn't remember the exact.
So I got into my fourth decade, the middle 30s, without having any idea who this Mark was. I just assumed he was an apostle.
Well, as does everybody. But of course, that's what the early church was after. I mean, they were really wanting us to.
Right.
So anyway, you kind of screwed me up. Where were we?
You were saying the Synoptic Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
No, I was back. I was beyond that. I was giving the dates they were roughly written.
Oh, all right.
And I can't remember which ones that we were. Thanks very much.
All right. So Mark, our first gospel, and it was written in the year probably 65 or 70.
Yeah.
I would put it closer to 70 because it does reference the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, which occurred in 70.
And that was actually something, as I said before, we would get back to that. That's how they're referencing this as the earliest gospel.
And interestingly enough, so we've had oral tradition for 40 years. The question is, why would someone write down a gospel? The answer may be that it was the destruction of Jerusalem that spurred this on. That we now no longer have a center of Jewish authority. Now we need to start writing stuff down so we have a written record to preserve it, these traditions.
Well, very much so. And the interesting thing is these Gospels, they weren't written in Aramaic. They were written in Greek.
And how do we know that?
I have no idea.
Your research was thorough.
Hey, thanks very much. You were supposed to be tossing in on this too.
Sorry. We know that because when they quote the Bible, they quote the Septuagint.
Oh, wait. Okay.
Which was...
yeah, I remember reading about that.
It was commissioned by Ptolemy, one of the Ptolemies anyway, and he got it's called a Septuagint because he got 70 Hebrew scholars, and they translated it into Greek. And so when they reference the Bible, when they reference like Micah or Deuteronomy or these Old Testament verses, they reference the Septuagint. So we know that the Bible, the New Testament, is written in Greek. Also, very telling is in is it in Matthew or John? Where it's in John when Christ is arguing with Nicodemus, and he says, "You need to be born again."
Yeah,
and Nicodemus says, "What do you mean? I need to crawl back into my mother's womb and then be born again?" He said, "No, you need to be born like from above, from the Spirit." Now, the Greek term "anathane" can mean from above, or again, or a second time. That pun totally falls flat in English. If you read it in Greek, you can see why Nicodemus is confused, because the Greek term means
three different things.
Right. It means a second time, or again, or from above. And Jesus meant from above, but Nicodemus, you know, it's kind of funny in Greek, but that pun also doesn't work in Aramaic. So you know that gospel was not written in Aramaic, it's written in Greek.
Okay, well, smarty pants. How many generations did Matthew say that Jesus was born after Abraham, and how many generations did Luke say?
One of them was 7, and the other one was 14. I can't remember which one.
Really? Because my sources were saying Matthew said it was 41 generations from Abraham, and Luke was saying 56.
Oh, you break it into sevens, I think, with one of them. It's like 14 generations to David, and then like another 14 to... there's some other big event. Oh, the Babylonian captivity, and then I think another 14 into Jesus' time, 14 from Adam to... So, yeah. So that, who was the 56?
The 56 was Luke.
Was Luke, yeah. But the reason is because of the and then, but the genealogies are different.
Yeah, and that's what I'm getting into now, is we have the Gospels here. They were all supposedly taken from Christ, and they were all written about Christ. And every time someone reads these, they gloss over the fact there are differences. Take for the fact, when was Jesus born? Because in Matthew, it says he was born when Herod was king of Judea. Luke says he was born when Cyrenius was governor of Syria.
Quirinius.
Quirinius. I've never been good at these names. And you love to rub
them. I love it. I love it. Yeah, and the problem is Herod died in 4 BC.
Exactly.
So that's the commonly, for me anyway, that's what I've heard. Jesus was born in 4 BC. And they put that because it's the farthest one out. And the closest to Quirinius, who assumed his station in 6 AD.
Yeah.
So there's a 10-year gap. And I love it that Christ was born 4 years before Christ.
Well, you know, he's just got to do that.
I'm all right.
You're going to be hacking. All right. Now, interestingly enough...
Wait, on the genealogies too.
Oh, all right.
Those genealogies go through... Now, remember, Matthew and Luke have the nativity scenes. Both genealogies go through Joseph. Well, that doesn't matter because Joseph didn't contribute any genes to Jesus.
No, that's actually a very good point here. God came down, he impregnated her, and we're still wondering when God's going to pay child support.
They should have done their genealogies through Mary. It doesn't matter if Joseph was a descendant of David because Joseph didn't contribute any genetic material to Jesus. Now you hear, oh, well, in Matthew it was through Joseph, and in Luke they were through Mary. That's why the genealogy. No. Both of them specifically say they're through Joseph. And they both say the virgin birth. So it doesn't make any sense.
Yep, yep. And yet, what gospel don't we get the virgin birth in? Oh, yeah, Mark, the earliest.
And John, the latest. There's no virgin birth in John.
Very good. Very good point. Now, curiously enough, how long did Jesus' ministry actually occur?
It depends on which gospels you read. The Synoptics?
The Synoptics is about a year. John's Gospel, 3 years.
Yeah, because he goes through multiple Passovers. and so typically people say, well, the Synoptics just left out some details. The ministry lasted 3 years. So Jesus was like 33 when he died, and he ended up being crucified in 29 or 30 of the common era. Yeah. That's how they reconcile that stuff. But yeah, if you read them just on their own, there's a discrepancy of 1 and 3 years. Did you hit the where Jesus, what day he was crucified on?
No, I hadn't crossed that.
Again, it depends on which gospel you read. In the synoptics, he was crucified the day after Passover.
I remember that from a while ago when I was making the comparisons.
Yeah, he was crucified around 9 o'clock in the morning. So he goes, he has the Last Supper, he has the Passover feast. He says, this is my body, you know, which is my blood,
et cetera, et cetera. Drink it, cannibalize me.
He goes to the garden, he gets arrested, he gets put before the Sanhedrin, he gets put before Pontius Pilate and is crucified in the morning. In John, Jesus was crucified the day of the preparation of Passover at noon. He does have a meal, but he doesn't break the bread and say, this is my body and this is my blood. I think he washes their feet or something.
Yeah, he does.
And then he gets crucified. He goes through Pontius Pilate, et cetera, et cetera. He gets crucified very specifically at noon when the lambs for Passover are being sacrificed.
Yep, and there we get the similarity, and which, again, is probably one of the things that contributed to the lamb being nailed to the cross.
So clearly, he's making a theological point, Jesus is the Lamb of God. But in the synoptics, Jesus lived through that whole day. He was crucified the next morning, not in John. That, I think, you cannot reconcile. You can't bring those together. He either was crucified the day after Passover or the day of Passover.
Now, interestingly enough, I'm going to read you a passage, actually, from one of the articles I was reading. I'll have the link up on the side, but it says, Matthew declares that he was born in Bethlehem in fulfillment of a prophecy in the book of Micah, but the prophecy of Micah has nothing whatever to do with Jesus. It prophesies the coming of a military leader, not a divine teacher. Matthew's application of this prophecy to Christ strengthens the suspicion that his gospel is not history, but romance.
Oh, sure. What happens when you think that your guy's the Messiah, but he doesn't appear to be the Messiah as described in the Old Testament, right? You go through and you get a bunch of stuff, like Isaiah doesn't mention a Messiah. Yeah. He mentions a suffering righteous man. Oh, we'll just combine that, and that'll be the Messiah.
Toss that right in together.
The Micah reference is important because he says the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. But we have a problem because clearly everyone knows that Jesus was of Nazareth. So Matthew and Luke get there from different areas. They have them both born in Bethlehem. But in Matthew, Bethlehem's his hometown.
Yep.
In Luke, he's there because of the census of Quirinius.
And that's actually where I was going next with this. Is in Luke, he talks about the censor. Now, there is no censor in history that actually corresponds with this. And interestingly enough, the censor wouldn't have had everybody shipping off, especially with a pregnant woman, to go and get the censor taken.
On the face of this, the census is ridiculous. If they say, okay, we're not going to count you in your town right now. What we're going to do is we're going to count you in the town of your ancestors 1,000 years back. Where would you go? I have no freaking idea.
Yeah.
Who existed, my ancestors in the year 1000? I have no clue.
I'd be in Europe somewhere.
Not a clue. I'd have to consult some of my family members who have done extensive genealogy work. But they don't have that back then. It's all oral, right?
Yep.
It's ridiculous.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
And you're right. We have zero records in one of the best documented centuries of all antiquity. We have zero records of an empire-wide census that caused this amount of disruption. You think someone would have complained or written something about it.
Yeah, especially the someone who's dragging his pregnant wife ready to burst across just to get this taken care of.
It's a ridiculous, ridiculous story.
And
ridiculous
yet, story. The reason why is Jesus the Christ was supposed to be in Bethlehem.
Yeah, in Luke, his hometown was Nazareth. In Matthew, I think they go to Egypt, they come back to Bethlehem, but they can't stay because Herod the son of Herod has taken control and he's angry and he might kill Jesus. So then they go to Nazareth.
Yeah.
So it's totally different. And again, how do you reconcile this stuff? So are they disinterested histories of Jesus? Are these four gospels disinterested histories? Are they literal truths where they're just recording what actually happened? Or are they told, as they say, this is written so that ye might believe, as they themselves say. They have an agenda. They have a religious agenda. So how much can we trust? Well, scholars have come up with criteria to winnow away some of the stuff. One of it is multiple attestations. So if these are independent sources, Q, for example, which Matthew and Mark, or Matthew and Luke tell stories that aren't found in Mark, but they're the same stories. Mm-hmm. So they think that came from a separate source, probably a Sayings gospel called Q, which is German, like Quelle, German for source.
Yeah.
Pretty original. Mm-hmm. So there, if it's attested in Q, if it's attested then in Mark and John, those are independent sources. You can't say, well, if it's attested in Q and Matthew and Luke, if they got that story from Q, that's only one
testimony. One testimony. Yeah, exactly.
So if it's multiply attested, then you can feel better, at least, that that story is probably older than some of the new stuff, like Mark doesn't have the virgin birth, right?
Yeah.
So the virgin birth is only found in the later stuff. Maybe that's a new tradition. Maybe they made it up. So that's it's multiply attested in Matthew and Luke, but not in some in Paul, for example. Or yeah. You know, so anyway, for me, I discount that. So independent attestation is one. The criterion of dissimilarity, and here I'm following Bart Ehrman's criteria.
Which, I mean, both you and me and Charlie, as you can tell, we are big fans of Bart Ehrman. We love his scholarly research into this.
Yeah, I disagree with him on Josephus. I think he's way too easy on Josephus. And there are a bunch of other things that I'm questioning about. But I think, by and large, he's a really good scholar and not probably the most rigorous thinker. He comes up with some problems, but certainly not as sloppy as, say, the guy who wrote Angels and Demons, Dan Brown. Oh, it's an unfair comparison because Brown isn't a scholar. But
yeah, yeah, that was a pathetic piece of fiction.
As a little digression, I almost burst out laughing when he has this the guy, the main character of the story in Angels and Demons, talking to his class about how a lot of the elements of Christianity were borrowed from pagan sources. I'm like, all right, I can get all on right, this
that's
bandwagon.
Good. That's truthful.
Great, great. He says, for example, the idea that of eating your god was borrowed from the Incas and the Mayans. And I'm like, what?
No.
All right.
Egypt, thank you very much.
So you're telling me Christians sailed across the Atlantic, landed in, took a historical survey of the religious practices of Incas and Mayans, and then sailed back. And brought this in there and didn't tell anybody about the New World. That waited till, 1492.
Yeah. And it absolutely astonishes me that everybody loves this book out there, and this doesn't even...
I almost had to stop reading. It was the most ridiculous piece of garbage. And this guy was set up as a scholar for this stuff.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, that's a digression.
Criterion of dissimilarity. Which at first, it seems not to make sense, but if you think about it, it does. If you're, say, brought in to testify against a good friend, and you testify that he actually did commit the murder, that testimony is valuable because it's against your interests, right? Yeah. You typically wouldn't do that.
And I know exactly where you're going with this, where Jesus is concerned.
This, if we're going to give the whole thing away like you already did 20 minutes ago, this is why I believe Jesus actually existed. This criterion alone.
I didn't give it all away, so just shut up.
You shot your wad.
Well, I am last of the Minutemen, thank you very much.
So if you apply this to the Gospels, Paul himself, I believe, said the biggest stumbling block to
Christianity moving forward,
to converting Jews, for example, was that Christ was crucified. And in the Old Testament, they have saying that he who's hanged up on a tree is cursed. And it's just like saying, well, Charles Manson, for example,
Uncle Charlie,
put in jail. He really is a prophet. Or David Koresh, who got blown up. He ran afoul of the government, got blown up in Waco, Texas. But guess what? He's really a prophet. It's hard to take that stuff seriously. So if they say it, and it's a stumbling block to converting people,
it's a little bit contrary to what you would be saying about a divine figure such
as this. They probably didn't make that up. They probably didn't make up that he was baptized by John, because early in the first century, early Christianity thought that the person who baptized
had more authority and more
was
power,
was spiritually superior than the person who got baptized. And that's why I think you see these early apologetics, John saying, I'm not worthy to baptize you.
Yeah.
Probably didn't happen. Jesus probably ended up learning from John. He probably spent a bunch of time with John, learning apocalyptic message and et cetera, et cetera, and then went out preaching.
Yep.
I doubt, seriously doubt, that certainly you don't have the Annunciation or even the Virgin Birth, really, where they say, hey, by the way, you're going to have the Son of God born to you. Because in Mark, you have in the middle of, he's preaching, and Mary, his mother, and a bunch of his brothers come over, and they want to haul Jesus away because they think he's crazy. That probably actually happened, right?
Yeah.
And if that happened, there's no way there was a virgin birth. There's no way that an angel came down and told Mary.
Because, yeah, I mean, if Mary gave birth as a virgin, God came down and impregnated me. Yeah, I'm going to stop my boy from going out there and being crazy.
So there are a bunch of stuff in Jesus' mythology that I don't think people would have made. If they're sitting down to make up a religion or co-opt a religion and polish it up, they probably would not have made up a suffering Messiah. It was unknown before Christianity. And still, a major stumbling block for Jews. This wasn't what the Messiah was supposed to be like. He was supposed to be a figure of grandeur, right? Say nothing of the Son of Man. He was supposed to, according to Daniel, ride on clouds in judgment. This wasn't Jesus. He was a preacher.
Yep, and that's exactly how they're viewed. And there's 1,000 years and more of apologetics of people in modern Christianity trying to account for all of this.
Yeah. The third criteria and the final one is contextual credibility, which is, if it doesn't sound like it happened in the first century, it probably didn't happen in the first century. Remember, Jesus is an itinerant, apocalyptic preacher. He was thoroughly Jewish. His followers were thoroughly Jewish. If you find stuff that Jesus is saying that doesn't fit inside that context, he probably didn't say it. And you have a lot of this stuff where people are talking about apostles. And for example, I find it really hard to believe that any of the apostles wrote any of this. Maybe they found a scribe and paid the scribe. But can you imagine them, you know, like Mark or John or Matthew may have been literate because he was a tax collector, possibly.
Possibly, but he's more mathematical in number.
Right. Yeah. Luke, probably, since he was a physician. Can you imagine Peter, for example, who's an illiterate, it says in Acts, he's illiterate. Can you imagine him saying, all right, I'm going to stop preaching for a while. This, I think, was in Jesus Interrupted, this line of reason. I'm going to stop preaching for a while. Go to school, learn a foreign language, learn Greek. I'm going to learn it so well that I can write a narrative in it, and then I'm going to come back and continue preaching. Doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, it makes sense to me. I mean, what's wrong with you? You never educated yourself?
Yeah, they've got all the time in the world in ancient, what do you call it, Judea or Israel?
Middle East. No problem. Somewhere over in that desert area.
I'm kind of astounded that Jesus knew how to read. It's very unusual for kind of a backwater Galilean.
That must be one of his miracles. I mean, he was a carpenter's son, after all. So what the hell does he need to know about reading for?
Yeah, the fact that he's from Nazareth, I think, probably also is true because there were no prophecies about anyone coming from Nazareth. Hence the problem for Matthew and Luke.
Bethlehem. Yeah.
So I don't think that the Gospels are particularly reliable as a source of historical information. They need to be read with a critical eye. You need to use these criteria to kind of sift out the stuff. And I think the more you read these things as synoptics, the more you read one event in Mark and then read that event in Matthew and that event in Luke, the more these discrepancies pop up.
Yeah. Well, as my father always liked to point out, they were all telling the same story, but they would add different aspects.
Yeah, it's like the elephant, right? The blind man, one thought it was a snake, the other thought it was a tree trunk and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Well, they're all true. It's just a different part of the elephant.
Of course, yeah.
Apparently, the apostles were all blind and
fondling like to feel an elephant. Jesus. Well, we both went two different ways on that.
Yeah, feeling up Jesus. excellent.
Well, I often like to feel up Jesus, but that's only when I'm in church.
So there we go. My opinion, did Jesus exist? My personal opinion, yeah, there probably was a wandering Jewish apocalyptic preacher in the first century. But I really believe that the message that he preached is not the message of current Christianity.
No, it's the message of the world is ending, everybody run for the hills.
Oh, I did want to say one of the things that I thought Bart Ehrman was a little sloppy on is that the criterion of, say, contextual credibility, for example, is able to rule things out. But just because it's contextually credible,
it's not able to
you can't automatically rule things in.
Yeah.
So it's good for winnowing things out. Now, the same thing for the criterion of dissimilarity, which he really likes. The criterion of dissimilarity rules things in, but it doesn't really rule things out. In other words, if you use the criterion of dissimilarity, if things were similar to what Christians would like to say to other people, then you would have to come up with a church that is totally 180 degrees different from what Jesus preached. You can't allow any thing that might work for the Christians to be in there. So really, all you can do is say, well, it passes that criterion of dissimilarity, therefore, I think it's more likely to be true. But you cannot use the criterion of dissimilarity to do the reverse. It is similar. This gives Jesus, like, for example, the resurrection, which you can excuse on other grounds. But the resurrection, you can't automatically discount on terms of dissimilarity. Say, well, that's what Christians would say, so therefore, you can throw it out.
Yeah,
I think he's a little sloppy in that reasoning. It's very good for excluding stuff, not very good for, or very good for ruling stuff in, not very good for excluding stuff.
Yeah, so Bart Ehrman, if you're out there listening to this, we both know that you were attempted to be on the Nick and Josh podcast, Nick being our last guest speaker. So when you come on here, don't worry, we'll like to reprimand you for that.
I would like to pin you down on some of this stuff. I know he's a PhD and he'll run circles around
me. Oh yeah, your head's
gonna spin. I want to set his feet to the fire on some of this stuff. I want to get Josephus. I want to see why he's so...
Why does he like Josephus?
I don't know.
Because I've noticed that as well.
Why does he go so easy on that stuff? What's your motive for accepting that? And maybe he knows a bunch of stuff that we don't.
Yeah, well,
I mean, suppose it's possible.
We're being introduced to stuff every day. He's the one that's actually reading this in the actual language.
There's a small chance that he knows a little bit more about this stuff.
I wouldn't think so. No. We're both quite bright. Yeah.
And I'm sure he's listening to this podcast right now with rapt attention. He's probably...
going a couple of dipshits.
There you go. Well, all right.
A couple of dipshits signing off. Thanks for joining us. I'm not going to do that.